I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar.
To have been alive during the last 60 years is to have lived with the music of Paul Simon. The boy from Queens scored his first hit record in 1957, just months after Elvis Presley ignited the rock era. As the songwriting half of Simon and Garfunkel, his work helped define the youth movement of the 1960s. On his own in the 70s, Simon made radio-dominating hits. He kicked off the 80s by reuniting with Garfunkel to perform for a half a million New Yorkers in Central Park. 5 years later, Simon's album Graceland sold millions and spurred an international political controversy, and it hasn't stopped there. He's also lived one of the most vibrant lives of modern times, a story replete with tales of Carrie Fisher, Leonard Bernstein, Bob Dylan, Woody Allen, Shelley Duvall, Nelson Mandela, drugs, depression, marriage, divorce, and much more. All of it told in his life story, and it is by Peter Ames Carlin in his new book, Homeward Bound, the first major biography of one of the most influential popular artists in American history. And it is a pleasure to welcome Peter Ames Carlin to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Very nice to have you on the program. So what brought you to Paul Simon as a subject?
Well, you know, I'd heard his music throughout my life. I mean, I remember hearing Mrs. Robinson when I was 5 years old, you know, sitting in the backyard of my parents' house. And you know, all the other bigger kids in the neighborhood had their transistor radios on all summer. So between Memorial Day and Labor Day, I think I heard that dee 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 dee, you know, about every 18 minutes. So that was a big indoctrination, and just from that time forward, I mean, Paul's voice has been a part of my just day to day experience of living. I mean, just because his songs were always on the radio. And, you know, it seems like every moment, you know, I look back at every year of my own life over the last 50 odd years, and there's like a new Paul Simon song that was a part of every moment, you know. So, you know, that seems significant to me personally, but then also realizing how much American history he's played a role in, writing songs that resonated through the civil rights movement, you know, into the, you know, sort of the rock era, the 60s, and the sort of neo-psychedelic era, and, you know, his playing a role in the, you know, in the board of the Monterey Pop Festival and helping that get going. And, you know, he's just been a part of so much music and culture, I mean, including the foundation of Saturday Night Live in the mid-70s and working with, you know, acting in a Woody Allen movie and Annie Hall and making his own movie and, you know, and then, of course, the anti-apartheid movement and the controversies with Graceland in the mid-80s and on and on and on and on. So it just seemed like, you know, there's an essentially American story in Paul's life and career and particularly in his music that seemed well worth telling.
Talk a little bit about the complicated relationship between Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel and how it worked in the beginning and started to erode as years went on.
Well, you know, they met when they were in grade school and really began to sing together and hang out together when they were about 11 and were, you know, both very musical, both very ambitious. You know, Paul's dad was a professional musician, so he kind of knew the industry from the sort of from the inside out, and it was a you know, they were extremely close as kids, and then when they finally, you know, they wrote a song that someone was interested in putting out, this tune called "Hey Schoolgirl in the Second Row," and managed to gain the interest of a president of a small independent label in New York, who desperately wanted to put the song out. And as Paul and his father were negotiating the contract in the fall of 57 for that first Paul and Artie song, they secretly hammered out a side deal for Paul to start a solo career for the same record label without mentioning it to Artie or his parents. And when Artie found out about it, you know, right before Paul's solo single was about to come out, he was, as you would imagine, enormously hurt and offended that Paul would have taken, you know, leveraged their first duo success into his own personal solo career, you know. And I think that, you know, they got over that eventually and worked together, you know, through the Simon and Garfunkel era quite well. And the love between them is obvious when you see them together and you hear them singing together. But there's also, I think, a very, you know, sort of a crack in that foundation, a sense of mistrust and resentment that that I think really goes back to that first moment, that that secret side deal that Paul made. And and as much as they love and sort of need each other musically and depend on one another, there's also between them this enough competition and resentment to make them resent each other for the extent that they depend on one another as well.
So when he went solo, he's a very comfortable solo artist, though, isn't he?
Yes. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, Paul is a very independent person and very controlling in his way and very stubborn. And so I think he very much enjoys being in absolute control. But the paradox is, you know, he's often done his best work in collaboration with others. I mean, obviously the Simon and Garfunkel era, that's all collaborative music. Whenever he goes to make a record in different culture, different type of music, he's collaborating intensely with the musicians from that place, you know, who specialize in that music, you know. And yet he very sort of defiantly refers to himself as a solo artist. And which is true, but only to the extent that he's always had a very strong supporting cast of people helping to shape and create his music. So it's a very sort of paradoxical sense of himself that he has.
Talk a little bit about what drew him to the Graceland project and how much he knew what he was getting into.
Well, one of the interesting things that I learned, I found most surprising, is that Paul actually recorded his first South African-inspired music in 1961, when he was 19, and producing and writing songs for this group called Tico and the Triumphs, a sort of a doo-wop group he discovered in Queens, in his neighborhood, and took under his wing. And what happened was... The Tokens, the band, had a huge hit with their cover of a song called The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which had been a hit in the U.S. originally for the Weavers in the late 40s under the name Wimoway, which was an adaptation of a South African song called Mbubi, which was written by a guy named Solomon Linda, a Zulu tribesman who adapted an old tribal hunting chant he knew as a child, but then connected it with some of the modern sounds he was hearing out of America in the records, like rhythm and blues music and jazz and ragtime, and that became a huge hit in South Africa. And so when Paul, he sort of recorded this kind of lame version of, you know, his own attempt to sort of take the Tokens and build upon that, in hopes of creating his own semi-exotic hit. But when he actually did connect with the modern South African pop music in the mid-80s, the Umbakonga music and the Township Jive and that kind of stuff, it was instantly familiar to him because it was the same kind of early rock and roll sound that he had fallen in love with in the early and mid-50s. And that's because a lot of that South African music shared the same heritage. You know, again, going back to Solomon Linda and his, you know, the way that he managed to blend Zulu music with pop music from the West to create a distinctly African sound. And so Paul, you know, I mean, fixated on that sound, and I think it reinvigorated him creatively in a lot of ways. And he went, you know, his usual standard operating procedure was to go to where, you know, if he heard music that was interesting to him, he would go to the source of the music and work with the people who made that music. But in this case, it was complicated because, you know, it was coming out of South Africa, which at that point was, governed by a racist apartheid government that kept the natives under their heel. Paul's decision to go record in South Africa appeared to be a violation of a cultural boycott that the African National Congress and the UN had, trying to, you know, to make sure that the apartheid government in South Africa wasn't treated as a normal government by the rest of the world. And so there was that conflict, but then also the sense of cultural appropriation. Is it appropriate for a white guy from New York City to be in Johannesburg making music with these African musicians? And so that was quite a, you know, it was a beautiful record that I think, you know, sold many millions of copies, and I think has, you know, a treasured piece of work that, you know, still owned by millions and millions, but also viewed as controversial and perhaps like the wrongest possible thing to do. But I think that ultimately, you know, Paul's ability to project the sounds and the feelings and the lives of these people to the rest of the world proved to be, I think, a significant force in, you know, what would become the end of apartheid within a few years.
The name of the book, and it is fascinating, is Homeward Bound, The Wife of Paul Simon. It is published by Henry Holt. Peter Ames, Carlin, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Homeward Bound, The Wife of Paul Simon. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet.